who, enraged by the defeat, held them back. Let this wicked drow Kiorl push Lolf's favored into the flames, the wretched Ertu decided. The gate would remain open with a sacrifice, might even open wider. Ertu did not like the banishment, did not like being lackey to any being. Let Lolf suffer, let Beenri be consumed, and only then would he do as the Spider Queen had asked. The only thing that saved Beenri from exactly that fate was the unexpected intervention of Methil, the Illithid. The Glabrezu had gone to Methil after visiting Jarlaxle, bringing the same prediction that House Beenri would prevail, and Methil, serving as ambassador of his people, made it a point to remain on the winning side. The Illithid psionic waves disrupted Kiorl's telepathic attack, and Matron Beenri slumped back to the side of the table. Kiorl's eyes went wide, surprised by the defeat, until Methil, who had been standing invisibly and secretly at Matron Beenri's side, came into view.
"Wait for this to end,"
Kiorl's thoughts screamed at the octopus-headed creature.
"See who wins, and decide where your alliances lie."
Methil's assurance that he already knew the outcome did not disturb Kiorl half as much as the sight of the gigantic bat-like wing that suddenly extended from the pillar of flame. A Tanari, a true Tanari. Another Glabrezu hopped out of the fire to land on the floor between Beenri and her adversary. Kiorl hit it with a psionic barrage, but she was no match for such a creature, and she knew it. She took note that the pillar was still dancing wildly, that another fiend was forming within the flames. Lolf was against her, she suddenly realized. All the abyss seemed to be coming to Matron Beenri's call. Kiorl did the only thing she could, became insubstantial once more, and fled across the city back to her house. Fiends rushed through the open gate, 100 of them, and still more. It went on for more than an hour, the minions of Ertu, and thus the minions of Lolf, coming to the call of the desperate matron mothers, swooping across the city in frenzied glee to surround House Oblodra. Smiles of satisfaction, even open cheers, were exchanged in the meeting room at the back of Kellar's Orl. The Avatar had done as promised, and the future of Lolf's faithful seemed deliciously dark once more. Of the 8 gathered, only Gromph wore a grin that was less than sincere. Not that he wanted House Oblodra to win, of course, but the male held no joy at the thought that things might soon be as they had always been, that he, for all his power and devotion to the ways of magic, would, above all else, be a mere male once more. He took some consolation, as the flames died away and the others began to exit, in noticing that several of the offered items, including his prized spider mask, had not been consumed by the magical flames. Gromph looked to the door, to the matron mothers and Triel, and they were so obsessed with the spectacle of the fiends that they took no notice of him at all. Quietly, and without attracting attention, the covetous drow wizard replaced his precious item under the folds of his robe, then added to his collection some of the most prized artifacts of Menzo Baranzon's greatest houses.
Part 3 Resolution. How I wanted to go to Catibri after I realized the dangers of her sword. How I wanted to stand by her and protect her. The item had possessed her, after all, and was imbued with a powerful and obviously sentient magic. Catibri wanted me by her side. Who wouldn't want the supportive shoulder of a friend with such a struggle looming? And yet she did not want me there, could not have me there, for she knew this battle was hers to fight alone. I had to respect her conclusion. And in those days when the time of troubles began to end, and the magics of the world sorted themselves out once more, I came to learn that sometimes the most difficult battles are the ones we are forced not to fight. I came to learn then why mothers and fathers seldom have fingernails, and often carry an expression of forlorn resignation. What agony it must be for a parent in Silvery Moon to be told by her offspring, no longer a child, that he or she has decided to head out to the west, to Waterdeep, to sail for adventure along the Sword Coast. Everything within that parent wants to yell out, "Stay!" Every instinct within that parent wants to hug the child close, to protect that child forever. And yet, ultimately, those instincts are wrong. In the heart, there is no sting greater than watching the struggles of one you love, knowing that only through such strife will that person grow and recognize the potential of his or her existence. Too many thieves in the realms believe the formula for happiness lies in an unguarded treasure trove. Too many wizards seek to circumvent the years of study required for true power. They find a spell on a scroll or an enchanted item that is far beyond their understanding, yet they try it anyway, only to be consumed by the powerful magic. Too many priests in the realms, and too many religious sects in general, ask of themselves and of their congregations only humble servitude. All of them are doomed to fail in the true test of happiness. There is one ingredient missing in stumbling upon an unguarded treasure hoard. There is one element absent when a minor wizard lays his hands on an archmage's staff. There is one item unaccounted for in humble, unquestioning, and unambitious servitude. A sense of accomplishment. It is the most important ingredient in any rational being's formula of happiness. It is the element that builds confidence and allows us to go on to other, greater tasks. It is the item that promotes a sense of self-worth, that allows any person to believe there is value in life itself, that gives a sense of purpose to bolster us as we face life's unanswerable questions. So it was with Catti Bree and her sword. This battle had found her, and she had determined to fight it. Had I followed my protective instincts, I would have refused to aid her in taking on this quest. My protective instincts told me to go to Brunner, who would have surely ordered the sentient sword destroyed. By doing that, or taking any other course to prevent Catti Bree's battle, I would have, in effect, failed to trust in her, failed to respect her individual needs and her chosen destiny, and thus I would have stolen a bit of her freedom. That had been Wolfgar's single failure. In his fears for the woman he so dearly loved, the brave and proud barbarian had tried to smother her in his protective hug. I think he saw the truth of his error in the moments before his death. I think he remembered then the reasons he loved Catti Bree, her strength and independence. How ironic it is that our instincts often run exactly opposite from what we truly desire for those we love. In the situation I earlier named, the parents would have to let their child go to Waterdeep and the Sword Coast. And so it was with Catti Bree. She chose to take her sword, chose to explore its sentient side, perhaps at great personal risk. The decision was hers to make, and once she had made it, I had to respect it, had to respect her. I didn't see her much over the next couple of 10 days, as she waged her private battle. But I thought of her and worried for her every waking moment, and even in my dreams. Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 12. Worth the Troubles.
"I have tricked Tanari to go to your city, Menzo Baranzon, and soon I must force them back," the great Ertu roared. "And I cannot even go to this place and join in their havoc, or even to retrieve them."
The Balor sat on his mushroom throne, watching the scrying device that showed him the city of Drow. Earlier, he was receiving fleeting images only, as this magic too struggled against the effects of the strange time. The images had been coming more strongly lately, though, and now the mirror-like surface was uncloudy, showing a clear scene of House Oblodra wedged between the fingers of the Claw Rift. Fiends great and minor stalked and swooped around the walled compound, banging strong fists against the stone, hurling threats and missiles of rock. The Oblodrans had buttoned the place up tightly,
For even with their psionic powers, and the fact that the fiend's magic fared no better than anyone else's, the otherworldly beasts were simply too physically strong, their minds too warped by evil to be much affected by telepathic barrages. And they were backed by a united army of drow, lying in wait behind the fiendish lines. Hundreds of crossbows and javelins were pointed House Oblodra's way. Scores of drow, riding sticky-footed subterranean lizards, stalked the walls and ceiling near the doomed house. Any Oblodran that showed her face would be hit by a barrage from every angle.
"Those same fiends are preventing the third house from being attacked,"
Ertu snarled at Lolth, reminding the Spider Queen whose army was in control here.
"Your minions fear my minions, and rightly so."
The beautiful drow, back in the abyss once more, understood that Ertu's outburst was one part outrage and nine parts bluster. No Tanari ever had to be tricked into going to the material plane, where it might wreak havoc. That was their very nature, the most profound joy in their miserable existence.
"You ask much, Lady of Spiders," Ertu grumbled on.
"I give much in return," Lolth reminded him.
"We shall see."
Lolth's red glowing eyes narrowed at the Tanari's continuing sarcasm. The payment she had offered Ertu, a gift that could potentially free the fiend from nearly a century more of banishment, was no small thing.
"The four Glabrazu will be difficult to retrieve," Ertu went on, feigning exasperation, playing this out to the extreme. "They are always difficult."
"No more so than a Balor,"
Lolth said in blunt response. Ertu turned on her, his face a mask of hatred.
"The time of troubles nears its end,"
Lolth said calmly into that dangerous visage.
"It has been too long," Ertu roared.
Lolth ignored the tone of the comment, understanding that Ertu had to act outraged and overburdened to prevent her from concluding that the Tanari owed her something more.
"It has been longer to my eyes than to your own, fiend,"
the Spider Queen retorted. Ertu muttered a curse under his smelly breath.
"But it nears its end,"
Lolth went on, quietly, calmly. Both she and Ertu looked to the image on the scrying surface just as a great winged Tanari soared up out of the claw rift, clutching a small, wriggling creature in one of its great fists. The pitiful catch could not have been more than 3 feet tall and seemed less than that in the massive fiend's clutches. It wore a ragged vest that did not hide its rust-colored scales, a vest made even more ragged from the tearing of the Tanari's clawed grasp.
"A kobold,"
Ertu remarked.
"Known allies of House Oblodra," Lolth explained. "Thousands of the wretches run the tunnels along the chasm walls."
The flying Tanari gave a hoot, grasped the kobold with its other clawed hand as well, and ripped the squealing thing in half.
"One less ally of House Oblodra,"
Ertu whispered. And from the pleased look on the Balor's face, Lolth understood Ertu's true feelings about this whole event. The great Tanari was living vicariously through his minions, was watching their destructive antics and feeding off the scene. It crossed Lolth's mind to reconsider her offered gift. Why should she repay the fiend for doing something it so obviously wanted to do? The Spider Queen, never a fool, shook the thoughts from her mind. She had nothing to lose in giving Ertu what she had promised. Her eyes were set on the conquest of Mithril Hall, on forcing Matron Bayenri to extend her grasp so that the city of Drow would be less secure and more chaotic, more likely to see inter-house warfare. The renegade Do-Urden was nothing to her, though she surely wanted him dead. Who better to do that than Ertu? Lolth wondered. Even if the renegade survived the coming war, and Lolth did not believe he would, Ertu could use her gift to force Drizzt to call him from his banishment, to allow him back to the material plane. Once there, the mighty Baelor's first goal would undoubtedly be to exact vengeance on the renegade. Drizzt had beaten Ertu once, but no one ever defeated a Baelor the second time around. Lolth knew Ertu well enough to understand that Drizzt O'Erden would be far luckier indeed if he died swiftly in the coming war. She said no more about the payment for the fiend's aid, understanding that in giving it to Ertu, she was, in effect, giving herself a present.
"When the time of troubles has passed, my priestesses will aid you in forcing the Tanari back to the abyss," Lolth said.
Ertu did not hide his surprise well. He knew that Lolth had been planning some sort of campaign, and he assumed his monstrous minions would be sent along beside the Drow army. Now that Lolth had clearly stated her intentions, though, the fiend recognized her reasoning. If a horde of Tanari marched beside the Drow, all the realms would rise against them, including goodly creatures of great power from the upper plains. Also, both Lolth and Ertu knew well that the Drow priestesses, powerful as they were, would not be able to control such a horde once the rampage of warfare had begun.
"All but one," Ertu corrected.
Lolth eyed him curiously.
"I will need an emissary to go to Drizzt O'Erden," the fiend explained, "to tell the fool what I have and what I require in exchange for it."
Lolth considered the words for a moment. She had to play this out carefully. She had to hold Ertu back, she knew, or risk complicating what should be a relatively straightforward conquest of the Dwarven Halls. But she could not let the fiend know her army's destination. If Ertu thought Lolth's minions would soon put Drizzt O'Erden, the great fiend's only chance at getting back to the material plane any time soon, in jeopardy, he would covertly oppose her.
"Not yet," the Spider Queen said. "Drizzt O'Erden is out of the way, and there he shall stay until my city is back in order."
"Menzo Berenzon is never in order,"
Ertu replied slyly.
"In relative order," Lolth corrected. "You will have your gift when I give it, and only then will you send your emissary."
"Lady of Spiders,"
the Baelor growled threateningly.
"The time of troubles nears its end,"
Lolth snapped in Ertu's ugly face.
"My powers return in full. Beware your threats, Baelor, else you shall find yourself in a more wretched place than this."
Her purplish-black robes flying furiously behind her, the Spider Queen spun around sharply and moved off, swiftly disappearing into the swirling mist. She smirked at the proper ending to the meeting. Diplomacy went only so far with chaotic fiends. After reaching a point, the time invariably came for open threats. Ertu slumped back on his mushroom throne in the realization that Lolth was in full command of this situation. She held the link for his minions to the material plane, and she held the gift that might allow Ertu to end his banishment. On top of all of that, Ertu did not doubt the Spider Queen's claims that the Pantheon was at last sorting itself out. And if the time of troubles was indeed a passing period, and Lolth's powers returned in full, she was far beyond the Baelor. Resignedly, Ertu looked back to the image on the scrying surface. 5 more kobolds had been pulled up from the claw rift. They huddled together in a tight group, while a host of fiends circled around them, teasing them, tormenting them. The great Baelor could smell their fear, could taste this torturous kill as sweetly as if he were among those circling fiends. Ertu's mood brightened immediately. Belwar Disengulp and a score of Zverfnebli warriors sat on a ledge, overlooking a large chamber strewn with boulders and stalactites. Each held a rope. Belwar's was fastened through a loop on his belt, and a mushroom-hide strap set over his pickaxe hand, that they might rappel quickly to the floor. For down below, the gnomish priests were at work, drawing runes of power on the floor with heated dyes, and discussing the prior failures and the most effective ways they might combine their powers, both for the summoning and in case the summoning, as had happened twice already, went bad. The gnomish priests had heard the call of their god, Sagogin, had sensed the returning of priestly magic. For the Zwerfnebli, no act could greater signify the end of this strange period. No act could better assure them that all was right once more than the summoning of an elemental earth giant. This was their sphere, their life and their love. They were attuned to the rock, at one with the stone and dirt that surrounded their dwellings. To call an elemental forth, to share in its friendship, would satisfy the priests that their god was well. Anything less would not suffice. They had tried several times. The first summoning had brought forth nothing, not even a trembling in the ground. The second, third, and fourth had raised tall stone pillars, but they had shown no signs of animation. Three of the stalagmite mounds in this very chamber were testament to those failures. On the fifth try, an elemental had come forth, and the gnomish priests had rejoiced, until the monster turned on them in rage, killing a dozen gnomes before Belwar and his troop had managed to break it apart. That failure was perhaps the very worst thing that could befall the gnomes, for they came to believe not only that Sagogin was out of their reach, but that, perhaps, he was angry with them. They had tried again, and again the elemental came forth only to attack them. Belwar's defenses were better in place that sixth time, as they were now, and the stone-limbed monster was beaten back quickly with no loss of Zwerfnebli. After that second disaster, Belwar had asked that the priests wait a while before trying again, but they had refused, desperate to find Sagogin's favor, desperate to know that their god was with them. Belwar was not without influence, though, when he had gone to King Schnicktick and forced a compromise. 5 days had passed since that sixth summoning, 5 days wherein the gnomish priests and all of Blingdenstone had prayed to Sagogin, had begged him to no longer turn against them. Unknown to the Zwerfnebli, those 5 days had also seen the end of the time of troubles, the realignment and correction of the pantheon. Belwar watched now as the robed priests began their dance around the rune-emblazoned circle they had drawn on the ground. Each carried a stone, a small green gem previously enchanted. One by one, they placed a gem on the perimeter of the circle and crushed it with a huge mallet. When that was completed, the high priest walked into the circle, to its very center, placed his gem on the ground, and, crying out a word of completion, smashed it under his mithril mallet. For a moment, there was only silence. Then the ground began to tremble slightly. The high priest rushed out of the circle to join his huddling companions. The trembling increased, multiplied. A large crack ran around the circumference of the enchanted area, separating that circle from the rest of the chamber. Inside the circle, rocks split apart and split again, rolling and roiling into a malleable mud. Bubbles grew and blew apart with great popping sounds, and the whole chamber warmed. A great head, a huge head, poked up from the floor. On the ledge, Belwar and his cohorts groaned. Never had they seen so tremendous an elemental. Suddenly, they were all plotting escape routes rather than attack routes. The shoulders came forth from the floor, an arm on each side, an arm that could sweep the lot of the priests into oblivion with a single movement. Curious looks mixed with trepidation on the faces of priests and warriors alike. This creature was not like any elemental they had ever seen. Though its stone was smoother, with no cracks showing, it appeared more unfinished, less in the image of a bipedal creature. Yet, at the same time, it exuded an aura of sheer power and completion beyond anything the gnomes had ever known.
"The glory of Sagogin are we witnessing,"
one gnome near Belwar squealed in glee.
"Or the end of our people,"
Belwar added under his breath so that none would hear. By the girth of the head and shoulders, the gnomes expected the monster to rise 20 feet or more. But when the trembling stopped and all was quiet again, the creature barely topped 10 feet. not as tall as many of the elementals even Singlesverf Neblin priests had previously summoned. Still, the gnomes had no doubt that this was a greater achievement, that this creature was more powerful than anything they had ever brought forth. The priests had their suspicions. So did Belwar, who had lived a long time and had listened carefully to the legends that gave his people their identity and their strength.
Entomach!
The most honored Burrow Warden gasped from his perch. And the name of the Prince of Earth Elementals, was echoed from gnome to gnome. Another name predictably followed, the name of Ogrimmok, Entomach's evil twin, and it was spoken sharply and with open fear. If this was Ogrimmok and not Entomach, then they all were doomed. The priests fell to their knees, trembling, paying homage, hoping beyond hope that this was indeed Entomach, who had always been their friend. Belwar was the first down from the ledge, hitting the ground with a grunt and running off to stand before the summoned creature. It regarded him from on high, made no move, and offered no sign as to its intentions.
Entomach!
Belwar shouted. Behind him, the priests lifted their faces. Some found the courage to stand and walk beside the brave Burrow Warden.
Entomach!
Belwar called again.
Answered our call, you have. Are we to take this as a sign that all is right with Sagogin, that we are in his favor?
The creature brought its huge hand to the floor, palm up, before Belwar. The Burrow Warden looked to the High Priest standing at his right. The priest nodded.
"To trust in Sagogin is our duty," he said.
And he and Belwar stepped onto the hand together. Up they rose, coming to a stop right before the behemoth's face. And they relaxed and were glad, for they saw compassion there and friendship. This was indeed Entomach, they both knew in their hearts, and not Ogrimmok, and Sagogin was with them. The elemental prince lifted its hand above its head and melted back into the ground, leaving Belwar and the high priest in the center of the circle, perfectly reformed. Cheers resounded through the chamber, and more than one rough-hewn Zverf Neblin face was streaked with tears. The priests patted themselves on the back, congratulated themselves and all the gnomes of Blingdenstone. They sang praises to King Schnicktick, whose guidance had led them to this pinnacle of Zverf Neblin achievement. For at least one of them, Belwar, the celebration was short-lived. Their god was back with them, it seemed, and their magic was returning. But what did that mean for the drow of Menzo Berenzon? The most honored Burrow Warden wondered. Was the Spider Queen too returned? And the powers of the drow wizards as well? Before all of this had begun, the gnomes had come to believe, and not without reason, that the drow were planning for war. With the onset of this chaotic time, that war had not come, but that was reasonable, Belwar knew, since the drow were more dependent on magic than were the gnomes. If things were indeed aright once more, as the arrival of Entomach seemed to indicate, then Blingdenstone might soon be threatened. All around the most honored Burrow Warden, gnomish priests and warriors danced and cried out for joy. How soon, he wondered, might those cries be screams of pain or shrieks of grief? Chapter 13. Repairing the Damage.
"Delicately!"
Fret whispered harshly, watching Drizzt's hands as the drow scraped and chipped away the dried salve around the neck of the panther figurine.
"Oh, do be careful!"
Of course Drizzt was being careful as the drow had ever been in any task. As important as the figurine appeared to be to Fret, it was 100 times more important to Drizzt, who treasured and loved his panther companion. Never had the drow taken on a more critical task, not with his wits or his weapons. Now he used the delicate tool Fret had given him, a slender silver rod with a flattened and slightly hooked end. Another piece of salve fell away. Almost a half inch along the side of the panther's neck was clear of the stuff. And clear of any crack, Drizzt noted hopefully. So perfectly had the salve bonded the onyx figurine that not a line could be seen where the break had been. Driest sublimated his excitement, understanding that it would inevitably lead him to rush in his work. He had to take his time. The circumference of the figurine's neck was no more than a few inches, but Drizzt fully expected, and Fred had agreed with the estimate, that he would spend the entire morning at his work. The Drow Ranger moved back from the figurine so that Fred could see the cleared area. The tidy dwarf nodded to Drizzt after viewing it, even smiled hopefully. Fred trusted in Lady Illustrial's magic and her ability to mend the tragedy. With a pat on Drizzt's shoulder, the dwarf moved aside and Drizzt went back to work, slowly and delicately, one tiny fleck at a time. By noon, the neck was clear of salve. Drizzt turned the figurine over in his hands, studying the area where the break had been, seeing no indication, neither a crack nor any residue from the salve, that the figurine had been damaged. He clasped the item by the head, and after a deep, steadying breath, dared to hold it aloft, with all the pressure of its weight centered on the area of the cut. It held fast. Drizzt shook his hand, daring it to break apart, but it did not.
"The bonding will be as strong as any other area on the item,"
Fred assured the drow.
"Take heart, that the figurine is whole once more."
"Agreed," Drizzt replied. "But what of its magic?" Fred had no answer. "The real challenge will be in sending one of our home to the astral plane," the drow went on.
"Or in calling the panther back," Fred added.
That notion stung Drizzt. The tidy dwarf was right, he knew. He might be able to open a tunnel to allow Guinevere to return home, only to have the panther lost to him forever. Still, Drizzt entertained no thoughts of keeping the cat beside him. Guinevere's condition had stabilized. Apparently the panther could indeed remain on the material plane indefinitely. But the great cat was not in good health or good spirits. While she seemed no longer in danger of dying, Guinevere roamed around in a state of perpetual exhaustion, muscles slack along her once sleek sides, eyes often closed, as the panther tried to find desperately needed sleep. "Better to dismiss Guinevere to her home," Drizzt said determinedly. "Surely my life will be diminished if I cannot recall Guinevere, but better that than the life Guinevere must now endure." They went together, the figurine in hand, to Drizzt's room. As usual, Guinevere lay on the rug in front of the hearth, absorbing the heat of the glowing embers. Drizzt didn't hesitate. He marched right up before the panther, who lifted her head sluggishly to regard him, and placed the figurine on the floor before her. "Lady Illustrial and good Fret here have come to our aid, Guinevere," Drizzt announced. His voice quivered a bit as he tried to continue, as the realization hit him that this might be the last time he ever saw the panther. Guinevere sensed that discomfort, and with great effort managed to sit up, putting her head in line with kneeling Drizzt's face. "Go home, my friend," Drizzt whispered. "Go home." The panther hesitated, eyeing the drow intently as if trying to discern the source of Drizzt's obvious unease. Guinevere, too, got the feeling, from Drizzt and not from the figurine, which seemed whole to the panther once more, that this might be a final parting of dear friends. But the cat had no control in the matter. In her exhausted state, Guinevere could not have ignored the call of the magic if she tried. Shakily, the cat got to her feet and paced around the figurine. Drizzt was both thrilled and scared when Guinevere's form began to melt away into gray mist, then into nothing at all. When the cat was gone, Drizzt scooped up the figurine, taking heart that he felt no warmth coming from it, that apparently whatever had gone wrong the last time he tried to send Guinevere home was not happening again. He realized suddenly how foolish he had been, and looked at Fred, his violet orbs wide with shock.
"What is it?"
the tidy dwarf asked.
"I have not Catty Bree's sword," Drizzt whispered harshly. "If the path is not clear to the astral plane,
The magic is right once more,
Fret replied at once, patting his hand soothingly in the air.
In the figurine, and in all the world around us, the magic is right once more.
Drizzt held the figurine close. He had no idea of where Catti Bree might be, and knew she had her sword with her. All he could do then was sit tight, wait, and hope. Brunner sat on his throne, Regis beside him, and the halfling looking much more excited than the dwarf king. Regis had already seen the guests that would soon be announced to Brunner, and curious Regis was always happy to see the extraordinary Harples of Long Saddle. Four of them had come to Mithril Hall, four wizards who might play an important role in defending the dwarven complex, if they didn't inadvertently take the place down instead. Such were the risks of dealing with the Harples. The four stumbled into the throne room, nearly running down the poor dwarf who had first entered to announce them. There was Harkle, of course, wearing a bandage around his face, for his eyes were already in Mithril Hall. Guiding him was Fat Regveld, who had ridden into the outer hall on a curious mount, the front of which resembled a horse, and the back of which had hind legs and a back end more akin to a frog. Regveld had appropriately named the thing Puddlejumper. The third Harple, Brunner and Regis did not know, and the wizard did not offer his name. He merely growled low and nodded in their direction.
"I am Belladon Delroy Harple," announced the fourth, a short and quite beautiful young woman,
except that her eyes did not look in the same direction. Both orbs were green, but one shined with a fierce inner light, while the other was dulled over and grayish. With Bella, though, that seemed to only add to her appearance, to give her fine features a somewhat exotic look. Brunner recognized one of the given names and understood that Bella was probably the leader of this group.
"Daughter of Delroy, leader of Long Saddle," the dwarf asked,
to which the petite woman dipped low in a bow, so low that her bright blonde mane nearly swept the floor.
"Greetings from Long Saddle, eighth king of Mithril Hall," Bella said politely. "Your call was not unheeded."
A pity, Brunner thought, but he remained tactfully quiet.
"With me are Harkle and Regveld,"
Regis interrupted, knowing the two quite well from a previous stay in Long Saddle.
"Well met, and it is good to see that your experiments in cross-breeding a horse and a frog came to fruition."
"Puddlejumper,"
the normally forlorn Regveld happily replied. That name promised a sight that Regis would like to see.
"I am the daughter of Delroy,"
Bella said rather sharply, eyeing the halfling squarely. "Please do not interrupt me again, or I shall have to turn you into something Puddlejumper would enjoy eating." The sparkle in her good green eye as she regarded Regis, and the similar glint in the halfling's gray orbs, told Regis that the threat was a hollow one. He heeded it anyway, suddenly anxious to keep on Bella's good side. She wasn't 5 feet tall, the halfling realized, and a bit on the heavy side, somewhat resembling a slightly larger version of Regis himself. Except that there was no mistaking her feminine attributes, at least not for Regis.
"My third companion is Bitterdew," Bella went on.
The name sounded curiously familiar to both Brunner and Regis, and came perfectly clear when Bitterdew answered the introduction with a bark. Brunner groaned. Regis clapped and laughed aloud. When they had gone through Long Saddle on their way to find Mithril Hall, Bitterdew, through use of a bad potion, had played the role of the Harple family dog.
"The transformation is not yet complete," Bella apologized,
and she gave Bitterdew a quick backhand on the shoulder, reminding him to put his tongue back in his mouth.
Harkle cleared his throat loudly and fidgeted about.
"Of course,"
Brunner said immediately, taking the cue.
The dwarf gave a sharp whistle, and one of his attendants came out of a side room, carrying the disembodied eyes, one in each hand. To his credit, the dwarf tried to keep them as steady as possible and aimed them both in Harkle's direction.
"Oh, it is so good to see myself again," the wizard exclaimed, and he spun around.
Following what he could see, he started for himself, or for his eyes, or for the back wall, actually, and the door he and his companions had already come through. He cried out,
"No, no!"
and turned a complete circle, trying to get his bearing, which wasn't an easy thing while viewing himself from across the room. Brunner groaned again. "It is so confusing," an exasperated Harkle remarked as Regveld grabbed him and tried to turn him aright. "Ah, yes," the wizard said, and turned back the wrong way once more, heading for the door.
"The other way!"
frustrated Regveld cried. Brunner grabbed the dwarven attendant and took the eyes, turning them both to look directly into his own scowling visage. Harkle screamed.
"Hey!" Brunner roared. "Turn around!"
Harkle calmed himself and did as instructed, his body facing Brunner once more. Brunner looked to Regis, snickered, and tossed one of the eyes Harkle's way, then followed it a split second later with the other, snapping his wrist so the thing spun as it soared through the air. Harkle screamed again and fainted. Regveld caught one of the eyes. Bittertoo went for the other with his mouth. Luckily, Bella cut him off. She missed, though, and the eye bounced off her arm, fell to the floor, and rolled around.
"That was very naughty, King Dwarf," the daughter of Delroy scolded. "That was..."
She couldn't maintain the facade and was soon laughing, as were her companions, though Bitterdew's chuckle sounded more like a growl. Regis joined in, and Brunner, too, but only for a second. The Dwarf King could not forget the fact that these bumbling wizards might be his only magical defense against an army of dark elves. It was not a pleasant thought. Drizzt was out of Mithril Hall at dawn the next morning. He had seen a campfire on the side of the mountain the night before and knew it was Catti Bree's. He still had not tried calling Gwenevar back and resisted the urge now, reminding himself to take on one problem at a time. The problem was now Catti Bree, or more specifically, her sword. He found the young woman as he came around a bend in the path, crossing into the shadows between two large boulders. She was almost directly below him, on a small flat clearing overlooking the wide, rolling terrain east of Mithril Hall. With the rising sun breaking the horizon directly before her, Drizzt could make out only her silhouette. Her movements were graceful as she walked through a practice dance with her sword, waving it in slow, long lines before and above her. Drizzt rested and watched approvingly of both the grace and perfection of the woman's dance. He had shown her this, and as always, Catti Bree had learned well. She could have been his own shadow, Drizzt realized, so perfect and synchronous were her movements. He let her continue, both because of the importance of this practice, and because he enjoyed watching her. Finally, after nearly 20 minutes, Catti Bree took a deep breath and held her arms out high and wide, reveling in the rising sun. "Well done," Drizzt congratulated, walking down to her. Catti Bree nearly jumped at the sound, and she spun around, a bit embarrassed and annoyed, to see the drow.
"Ye should warn a girl," she said.
"I came upon you quite by accident," Drizzt lied. "But fortunately, it would seem."
"I seen the Harples go into Mithril Hall yesterday," Catti Bree replied. "Have ye speaked with them?"
Drizzt shook his head. "They are not important right now," he explained. "I need only to speak with you." It sounded serious. Catti Bree moved to slide her sword into its scabbard, but Drizzt's hand came out, motioning for her to stop. "I have come for the sword," he explained.
"Cassid Hea?"
Catti Bree asked, surprised. "What?" asked the even more surprised drow.
"That is its name,"
Catti Bree explained, holding the fine blade before her, its razor-sharp edge glowing red once more.
"Cassid Hea."
Drizzt knew the word. A drow word, it meant to cut or cutter, and seemed an appropriate name indeed for a blade that could slice through solid stone. But how could Catti Bree know it, the drow wondered, and his face asked the question as plainly as words ever could.
"The sword telled me,"
Catti Bree answered. Drizzt nodded and calmed. He shouldn't have been so surprised. He knew the sword was sentient after all.
Kazetea, the drow agreed.
He drew Twinkle from its sheath, flipped it over in his hand, and presented it, hilt first, to Catti Bree. She stared at the offering blankly, not understanding.
A fair exchange, Drizzt explained. Twinkle for Kazetea.
Ye favor the scimitar,
Catti Bree said.
I will learn to use a scimitar and sword in harmony, Drizzt replied. Accept the exchange. Kazetea has begged that I be its wielder, and I will oblige. It is right that the blade and I are joined.
Catti Bree's look went from surprise to incredulity. She couldn't believe Drizzt would demand this of her. She had spent days, 10 days, alone in the mountains, practicing with this sword, connecting with its unnatural intelligence, trying to establish a bond.
"Have you forgotten our encounter?"
Drizzt asked, somewhat cruelly. Catti Bree blushed a deep red. Indeed, she had not forgotten and never would, and what a fool she felt when she realized how she, or at least how her sword, using her body, had thrown herself at Drizzt.
"Give me the sword," Drizzt said firmly, waving Twinkle's hilt before the stunned young woman. "It is right that we are joined."
Catti Bree clutched Kazetea defensively. She closed her eyes then and seemed to sway, and Drizzt got the impression she was communing with the blade, hearing its feelings. When she opened her eyes once more, Drizzt's free hand moved for the sword, and to the drow's surprise and satisfaction, the sword tip came up suddenly, nicking his hand and forcing him back.
"The sword does not want ye,"
Catti Bree practically growled.
"You would strike me?" Drizzt asked,
and his question calmed the young woman.
"Just a reaction,"
she stammered, trying to apologize. "Just a reaction," Drizzt silently echoed, but exactly the reaction he had hoped to see. The sword was willing to defend her right to wield it. The sword had rejected him in light of its rightful owner. In the blink of an eye, Drizzt flipped Twinkle over and replaced it on his belt. His smile clued Catti Bree to the truth of the encounter.
"A test," she said. "Ye just give me a test."
"It was necessary."
"Ye never had any mind to take, Kazetea,"
the woman went on, her volume rising with her ire.
"Even if I'd taken your offer."
"I would have taken the sword," Drizzt answered honestly. "And I would have placed it on display in a secure place in the Hall of Dumathoin."
"And ye would have taken back Twinkle," Catti Bree huffed. "Ye lion drow!"
Drizzt considered the words, then shrugged and nodded his agreement with the reasoning. Catti Bree gave an impertinent pout and tossed her head, which sent her auburn mane flying over her shoulder.
"The sword just knows now that I'm the better fighter," she said, sounding sincere.
Drizzt laughed aloud.
"Draw your blades, then,"
Catti Bree huffed, falling back into a ready posture.
"Let me show ye what me and me sword can do."
Drizzt's smile was wide as his scimitars came into his hands. These would be the last and most crucial tests, he knew, to see if Catti Bree had truly taken control of the sword. Metal rang out in the clear morning air, the two friends hopping about for position, their breath blowing clouds in the chill air. Soon after the sparring had begun, Drizzt's guard slipped, presenting Catti Bree with a perfect strike. In came Kazetea, but it stopped far short, and the young woman jumped back.
"Ye did that on purpose," she accused.
And she was right. And by not going for a vicious hit, she and her sword had passed the second test. Only one test to go. Drizzt said nothing as he went back into his crouch. He wasn't wearing the bracers, Catti Bree noticed, and so he wouldn't likely be off balance. She came on anyway, gladly and fiercely, and put up a fine fight as the sun broke clear of the horizon and began its slow climb into the eastern sky. She couldn't match the drow, though, and in truth, hadn't seen Drizzt fight with this much vigor in a long time.
When the sparring ended, Catti Bree was sitting on her rump, a scimitar resting easily atop each of her shoulders, and her own sword lying on the ground several feet away. Drizzt feared that the sentient sword would be outraged that its wielder had been so clearly beaten. He stepped away from Catti Bree and went to Kazidhea first, bending low to scoop it up. But Drow paused, though, his hand just an inch from the pommel. No longer did Kazidhea wear the pommel of a unicorn, nor even the fiendish visage it had taken when in the hands of Dantrag Beenri. That pommel resembled a sleek, feline body now, something like Gwenevar running flat out, legs extended front and back. More important to Drizzt, though, there was a rune inscribed on the side of that feline, the Twin Mountains, symbol of Dumathoin, the dwarven god, Catti Bree's god, the keeper of secrets under the mountain. Drizzt picked up Kazidhea, and felt no enmity, or any of the desire the sword had previously shown him. Catti Bree was beside him then, smiling in regard to his obvious approval of her choice for a pommel. Drizzt handed Kazidhea back to its rightful owner.
Chapter 14 The Wrath of Lolth.
Beenri felt strong again. Lolth was back, and Lolth was with her, and Kioral Odrin, that wretched Kioral, had badly erred. Always before, the Spider Queen had kept House Oblodra in her favor, even though the so-called priestesses of the house were not pious and sometimes openly expressed their disdain for Lolth. These strange powers of the Oblodrans, this psionic strength, had intrigued Lolth as much as it had frightened the other houses in Menzo Berenzon. None of those houses wanted a war against Kioral and her clan, and Lolth hadn't demanded one. If Menzo Berenzon was ever attacked from the outside, particularly from the Illithids, whose cavern lair was not so far away, Kioral and the Oblodrans would be of great help. But no more. Kioral had crossed over a very dangerous line. She had murdered a matron mother, and while that in itself was not uncommon, she had intended to usurp power from Lolth's priestesses and not in the name of the Spider Queen. Matron Beenri knew all of this, felt the will and strength of Lolth within her. "The time of troubles has passed," she announced to her family, to everyone gathered in her house, in the nearly repaired chapel. Mes Barris Armgo was there as well, in a seat of honor on the central dais, at Matron Beenri's personal invitation. Matron Beenri took the seat next to the matron mother of the second house as the gathered crowd exploded in cheers and led by Triel in song to the Spider Queen. "End it?" Mes Barris asked of Beenri, using the silent hand code, for they could not have been heard above the roar of 2,000 Beenri soldiers. "The time of troubles has ended," Beenri's delicate fingers responded.
"Except for House Oblodra," Mes Barris reasoned, to which Beenri only chuckled wickedly. It was no secret in Menzo Berenzon that House Oblodra was in serious trouble. No secret indeed, for the Tanari and other fiends continued to circle the Oblodran compound, plucking kobolds from the ledges along the Claw Rift, even attacking with abandon any Oblodran who showed herself.
"Kioral will be forgiven?" Mes Barris asked, popping up her left thumb at the end of the code to indicate a question. Matron Beenri shook her head once briskly, then pointedly looked away to Triel, who was leading the gathering and rousing prayers to the Spider Queen. Mes Barris tapped a long, curving fingernail against her teeth nervously, wondering how Beenri could be so secure in this decision. Did Beenri plan to go after House Oblodra alone? Or did she mean to call Barris and Delarmco into yet another alliance? Mes Barris did not doubt that her house and House Beenri could crush House Oblodra, but she wasn't thrilled at the prospect of tangling with Kioral and those unexplored powers. Methil, invisible and standing off to the side of the dais, read the visiting matron mother's thoughts easily, and in turn imparted them to Matron Beenri.
"It is the will of Lolth," Matron Behenry said sharply, turning back to regard Mes Baris.
Kioril has denounced the Spider Queen, and thus she will be punished.
By the Academy, as is the custom?
Mes Baris asked, and hoped. A fiery sparkle erupted behind Matron Behenry's red-glowing eyes.
By me,
she answered bluntly, and turned away again, indicating that Mes Baris would garner no further information. Mes Baris was wise enough not to press the point. She slumped back in her chair, trying to sort out this surprising, disturbing information. Matron Behenry had not declared that an alliance of houses would attack Oblotra. She had declared a personal war. Did she truly believe she could defeat Kioril? Or were those fiends, even the great Tanari, more fully under her control than Mes Baris had been led to believe? That notion scared the matron mother of Baris and Delarmgo more than a little, for if it were true, what other punishments might the angry and ambitious Matron Behenry hand out? Mes Baris sighed deeply and let the thoughts pass. There was little she could do now, sitting in the chapel of House Behenry, surrounded by 2,000 Behenry soldiers. She had to trust in Behenry, she knew. No, she silently corrected herself. Not trust, never that. Mes Baris had to hope Matron Behenry would think she was more valuable to the cause, whatever it might now be, alive than dead. Seated atop a blue-glowing drift disk, Matron Behenry herself led the procession from House Behenry, down from the Kellar's Orl and across the city, her army singing Lolf's praises every step. The Behenry Lizard Riders, Bergignon in command, flanked the main body, sweeping in and around the other house compounds to ensure that no surprises would block the trail. It was a necessary precaution whenever the first matron mother went out, but Matron Behenry did not fear any ambush, not now. With the exception of Mes Baris Armgo, no others had been told of the Behenry march, and certainly the lesser houses, either alone or in unison, would not dare to strike at the first house unless the attack had been perfectly coordinated. From the opposite end of the great cavern came another procession, also led by a Behenry. Triel Gromph and the other mistresses and masters of the Drow Academy came from their structures, leading their students every one. Normally, it was this very force, the powerful academy, that exacted punishment on an individual house for crimes against Menzo Berenzon. But this time, Triel had informed her charges that they would come only to watch, to see the glory of Lolth revealed. By the time the two groups joined the gathering already in place at the Claw Rift, their numbers had swelled 5 times over. Nobles and soldiers from every house in the city turned out to watch the spectacle, as soon as they came to understand that House Behenry and House Oblodra would finish this struggle once and for all. When they arrived before the front gates of House Oblodra, the Behenry soldiers formed a defensive semicircle behind Matron Behenry, shielding her, not from Kioril and the Odrin family, but from the rest of the gathering. There was much whispering, drow hands flashed frantically in heated conversations, and the fiends, understanding that some calamity was about to come, whipped into a frenzy, swooping across the Oblodrin compound, even exercising their returned magic with an occasional bolt of blue-white lightning or a fireball. Matron Behenry let the display continue for several minutes, realizing the terror it caused within the doomed compound. She wanted to savor this moment above all others, wanted to bask in the smell of terror emanating from the compound of that most hated family. Then it was time to begin. Or to finish, actually. Behenry knew what she must do. She had seen it in a vision during the ceremony preceding the war, and despite the doubts of Mes Baris when she had shared it with her, Behenry held faith in the Spider Queen, held faith that it was Lolth's will that House Oblodra be devoured. She reached under her robes and produced a piece of sulfur, the same yellow lump the Avatar had given her to allow the priestesses to open the gate to the abyss in the small room at the back of the Kellart's Orl. Behenry thrust her hand skyward, and up into the air she floated. There came a great crackling explosion, a rumble of thunder. All was suddenly silent. All eyes turned to the specter of Matron Bayenry, hovering 20 feet off the cavern floor. Bourguignon, responsible for his mother's security, looked to Sosumtu, his expression sour. He thought his mother was terribly vulnerable up there. Sosumtu laughed at him. He was not a priestess. He could not understand that Matron Bayenry was more protected at that moment than at any other time in her long life.
Kioral Odron, Bayenry called.